Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I travel to sit face-to-face with my guests in their own homes to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. Jay Johnson is probably best known for his appearances on the Trout Bum Diaries, Geobass, and most recently on the Fish or Die series on Animal Planet. Jay has a complex story, which he shares during this heartwarming episode. Be sure to also check out my new podcast, Into the Backing, where I sit down in a roundtable forum to hash out some of the outdoor industry's most controversial topics. There's a new episode dropping this week, so be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss it. This episode of Anchored is brought to you by Cross Current Insurance Group. Cross Current Insurance has asked me to remind everyone that fishing and travel can wait while we let our hospitals get caught up and our new normal start to take shape. Cross Current will be here for you when that time comes, and they ask that you take this time to focus on keeping your friends, families, and communities safe. You can learn more about Cross Current and their fishing-specific coverage at flyfishinginsurance.com. We're going to start where we start with everybody.
Okay.
So, where were you born and raised?
Well, a little town called Battleground, Washington.
Oh, yeah. I've been there.
Yeah. I think it's the kind of town. I mean, I'm very thankful. I was the darkest kid. So, and I was the poorest kid.
You're so unique looking. What are you? Like, what's your background?
My father said I was homo superior. So, which apparently is half Filipino, half Swede. A little bit of Norway, a little bit of Dane in me. And I take it, I mean, that I think that that kind of stuff has defined me. Like, that I'm, you know, anyway, I've been looking back at that stuff, and I think it's pretty cool to have, you know, where your bloodline comes from and like how we evolved to. Did you know Filipinos can drink salt water? Because we evolved on islands.
Did not. Can you drink salt water?
I could. Well, I drink salt. So I'm totally messing with you. Okay. I was put that on there. Anyway, yeah. So, Battleground, Washington. I'm a very very scattered person. You've known me long enough that you know that I'm very scattered.
That is all right.
I apologize every time.
I'll keep you on track. That's my job.
Yeah, if you can.
We got this.
I'll do my best.
But you've got these beautiful light eyes.
Oh, thank you.
So that's from the Swedish side.
I'd imagine, yeah.
So your dad, is he Filipino?
Swede.
And your mom is?
Yeah, okay. She was Filipino, yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, just lost them recently. Well, I just lost my mom recently. Very interesting story, but a long one.
Oh my God, I'm sorry. When?
Oh, a couple months ago.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, it was crazy. I'm really sorry. I did not know that.
It was brutal because I didn't know her growing up. Because I grew up in like group homes and foster homes and stuff. And so I didn't really know her. And then all of a sudden, I get this email. Or I get a Facebook message, which I never do Facebook messages. I got a Facebook message from her nurse. And she's like, I'm looking... Her mom's looking for it's been crazy. It's been a very wild ride. Like, and I say that every year, but like this year has been crazy, but cool. Like, I went down and saw her and like got to know her, and like she got to know me. She like didn't believe anything that I've done in my life. Because if you just tell someone you don't know, like, you know, I made a living doing karaoke for a while, or I traveled to Botswana to find something, or I've been working on a project in Nepal, or, you know, you tell them these things, you know, I got a TV show, this kind of stuff, and you don't know the lady. She's like, she's forever thinking I was just full of it, you know. And then she found out that I wasn't. She became like so proud and like understood. She understood me. She got to watch one of the episodes before she passed, you know. So that was cool.
Did she give you up for adoption?
No, she split. You know, it's a really heavy story. My dad did 9 tours in Vietnam. And that really, really messed him up. And so when he had us, he married a Filipino girl in the Philippines, and they moved here. And then, you know, my dad tried to kill my mom. And so it's pretty heavy in front of a little kid. I was 4 years old or something like that. And at that time, my mom put us in a car and we drove to Fort Worth, Texas, where we had some family from the Philippines over there. And Filipinos and families are of the most importance. So we lived there for a couple of years, and I got to visit my dad, and then went to see my dad and never saw her again. And my dad, like, I don't know if he broke... I like to think that he had a plan to, like, make me the ultimate survivalist, because he was that way, you know, but he raised me without electricity, water, or a phone. And so, you know, that put a lot of hood rat in me, which I'll respect for, like, the rest of my days, or, like, it's a part of me, you know. But also, it's, like, given me these opportunities to, like, be able to handle some really stressful situations, and it's a gnarly situation. And then eventually teach me the lessons that I'm going to learn. It's cool. I mean, I don't look back at it like it was a bad thing. I wouldn't trade it for the world. It's just brutal. It was tough because, you know, the group homes and stuff. Since I got in the group homes, like, everybody I was in a group home with is in jail or dead.
Do you have siblings?
Yeah, I got two sisters.
Were they able to come with you?
One of them came. One of them graduated without electricity. Imagine my other sister, Lee, is like, she's my hero. But she graduated valedictorian from her high school and got a full ride to the University of Washington. But no, you know, she's doing homework by candlelight, you know, in a very stressful situation, you know. So she's a badass. So she was always like, or she just led me in really positive ways, you know. So, yeah, so eventually we got into a foster home. And, you know, I've been very fortunate in people that are willing to love me, you know. It's been a tough month.
I know, it's so hard. I'm sorry. I'm servicing it.
No, but it's real. It's what it is, you know.
Yeah.
Are
your sisters still around?
Yeah. Yeah, I just saw the 50th birthday. We went back to Washington, and I saw my nephews. Anyway, yeah, what? it was sweet.
How old are you, Jay?
43.
No shit.
Yeah. Ain't getting no younger. I'm starting to think that I should start to think about the future.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Jeez, you've had an interesting ride. Well, let's plug through it. When did you start fishing? How did you start fishing?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, my dad would leave like $2 in the cupboard every day. And we would save that up and buy a bag of rice. And then we would use that next $2 to like buy a pound of hot dogs or hamburger. And then we'd fry rice every night and lunch and breakfast. So that was like our food intake. But every once in a while, we'd have enough hot dogs for the next day. And so my sister would split it with us. But I would get the least because I was the youngest, you know. So they would get like 75 cents. They would get 75 cents and I would get 50 cents. I would save that shit up. And there was like a Plano tackle box at the local hardware store in Battleground. And I remember it was $9. And I saved up 50 cents at a time to buy $9. Sometimes I would save. We would be like, okay, we're going to buy chips and shit like that for $2. You know, we're going to split $2 and everybody's going to get their stuff. And I would just save and I wouldn't eat. And so I could get that tackle box. And a skateboard. But first it was that tackle box. And then I started raiding my dad's tackle box. I'd never been fishing before in my life. I was like...
But he was a fisherman.
He was a fisherman, yeah.
Is he still around?
No.
Oh, he's gone? Oh,
yeah,
sorry.
He passed. No, it's just what it is. It's what it is. I think he did a bang-up job. Considering the cards he got dealt... If I got dealt his cards, I couldn't pull it through. I think I would.
You'd make it work. But, okay, so he fished, so...
Yeah, we went fishing like twice. And... We went out to buy this lake and he, like, we didn't really know each other. It wasn't like we hung out or like had dinner together or anything like that. It was like he was building crazy machines and I was playing in the creek in the backyard, you know. So anyway, he took me fishing once and we eat rice and hamburger or hot dogs. And we went to the concession stand. I was like, this is such a big deal, dude. This is a big deal in my life. Like, I'm going to eat something else, you know. And he ordered for me. He got two hot dogs. He put mustard. I hated mustard. I was like, and that's when I realized, man, we don't really know each other at all. Like, we don't have any idea who each other are. I was a little kid, so I wasn't getting too deep on the thought, you know. But a fish, you know, he rigged it all up, and a fish hit my bobber, and I freaked out. I was like, I can't do this. It was a monster, you know. Like, I know everybody says it was a monster, but I'm pretty positive. Like, if I saw it today, I'd be like, dude, like, what the, you know, but anyway, and he made me take it, or he made me fight it, and we went fishing, like, maybe twice, and I was stealing all of his lures, because there was a creek in the backyard, and we, like, anyway, we'd catch crawdads, and, like, little tiny steelhead smolt, probably a tributary of the East Fork Lewis. I mean, that's where that creek is, where what made me connect. Like you had a time when you connected with the outdoors, where you were like, you know, all the little things. And that's kind of what I tell the kids now, is like, make them make the death connection. It's like when you nurture something, it grows and it gets a little better. When you're hard on something, it dies and it gets worse. And that little connection, once they make that little magic connection in the wild world, then they want to participate a little bit. It gives them interest. I hope, or I'm wrong and I've wasted my whole life.
It might even be one of the first lessons in having a little bit of power.
Yeah, sure, you know, for sure.
What was high school like for you?
I was a musician, and so I was a comic book artist. That the first thing that saved my life was comic book artists, because I was getting, you know, in the group homes and foster home stuff, not my foster home, but the group home stuff, like the difficulty of getting any sort of love is too difficult. But what I found is if you did stuff well, like applied everything you had to it and like just went for it, people would love you, you know, like people.
And you got words of affirmation.
Yeah, which was very valuable as a kid that just like is so lost, you know what I mean? I'm like, I'm finding comic book drawing, or I'm finding, you know, drawing comic books and music. That's, I mean, I hate to put all comic book artists and music in the same sleeping bag of doom, but like, for a kid like me, it spoke straight to my soul. And like, if I practice and work together, and that's how my dad passed, is like, whatever you do, do it better than everyone else. Give all you have to it, you know. An interesting little lesson he gave you. Well, anyway.
When did you leave? Did you get taken from your dad's care?
Yeah, I was summer of my sixth grade year.
That's a hard age.
Dude, it was brutal.
Why did they take you?
Because, I went up swimming at the lake. Like, we could ride our bikes to this lake with a friend, and I didn't leave a note to where I was, but we never talked. So I was like, I leave all the time and I don't write notes. You know what I mean? Like, I know I was supposed to probably write a note. Not trying to, yeah, it's probably my fault.
No.
We got back from the lake. I was at my friend's house and he gave me a belt in the street with a leather belt. And then so the neighborhood called Child Protective Services and they came to the house and they saw there was no electricity, no water and all that kind of stuff. And like put us in the group home like a safe house and then put us in a group home, which I thought that was the worst thing that ever happened to me, that they took me away from that.
Did he fight for you?
What he said was that he saw when we got into the group home eventually, Betty, like my little best friend growing up was what lived across the street from us. And his parents were like, those kids aren't going to survive in that group home. Everybody's trying to figure out what to do with us, you know? And so they lived in an apartment. They managed my apartment complex and like had to stuff two more kids into that thing to help us out, you know? But then I saw my dad like months later and he said that we looked so happy there. You know, that because it was the first time we had like a television, a Nintendo, like a dinner table, that kind of stuff. You know, so I lived my whole life till sixth grade year on a couch. I lived on the couch in the living room. You know, so he probably saw it. He was probably right, but at the time I was like, get me out of here. You know, I want to go back home. You know, but I mean, that's Homo sapien probably in traumatic times. You know, they find a normality to it and start to miss it, you know, or whatever. Yeah, and again, I wouldn't trade it. I don't want to be that kid that grew up. I want to be the kid that grew up and earned it. You know what I mean? I like that. I just don't know any other way.
Did you end up developing a relationship with your dad?
Yeah. Okay. Like 24 years old, we started hanging out. I took him fishing a few times. Oh, no, he came saw me play. I wasn't even fishing. I didn't start fishing until I was like 26, like fly fishing. Then I started touring around, playing music, you know. So it was like everything has been a whirlwind, no stop. Cause then, so, you know, I was doing the comic book thing. I was like, oh, people, that's cool, you know. And then got a job offer for comic books. But I was at the time also playing string bass.
Did you graduate high school?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, did you go to college?
Yeah.
Who paid for your college?
Well, I got scholarships to play bass.
Okay.
I had scholarships to play bass all over the place. Like, I was heavy as shit. Like,
got it. This makes sense.
Because I would work my ass off harder than anybody else would, you know, and I had enough of a brain about me that, I mean, jazz is a very, you have to have jazz in your life to even try to speak the idiom, you know. When you're a kid listening to fucking NWA and the cool shit, you know, But the jazz band was that thing where, like, we were doing these competitions. Like, in high school, we got, like, jazz band of the year and, like, got sent to Europe to go play the 50th anniversary of World War II, you know. Like, we were doing heavy. I mean, like, we were crushing. We were always crushing, you know. And so all the schools were like, oh, come. But I'm like, man, I'm a comic book artist. I just got it, you know, I just got a job. I'm out of here. Not that I was trying to get out of anywhere. I mean, but anyway.
So you got this comic book job.
Yeah, well, fresh out of college? I started drawing it. I started working on the big sheets for it.
Okay.
And then this guy, Dr. Larry Zagantz, had a doctorate from Juilliard. And he's like, what are you doing, you idiot? You should be playing music. Come study with me. And he brought this guy from South Africa. And this guy would fly all the way to South Africa to study with this dude, you know. And I love jazz. I was, like, at that time, I was hooked as much as I could be, you know. And so I started studying with him. He's like, you will not play all that heathen music. You'll only play with a bow, you know, all this kind of stuff for, like, 2 years, you know. Because he saw that, like, this kid could do it, but he's got to have technique, you know. I mean, because that's like everything in life, right? Like, you could fumble dick through everything in life, but when you actually have to do it, you're going to have to work on it until proper technique is going to actually make an effect on, you know what I'm saying, right?
Absolutely, okay. Yeah. And he's from Juilliard, so he would have taken study very seriously.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was Dr. Larry Zagantz. Like, he's the method book, his homie. He helps write the method book for string bass, you know, like, he's heavy duty.
So how old were you during all of this? This is early 20s.
I graduated when I was 17.
Okay. High school.
Yeah.
And then you graduated college when you were probably...
I didn't graduate college. I started going on tour. So I started studying with Larry. And right. Then, or Dr. Zagantz. I'd never call him Larry. He'd probably smack me.
Right.
but anyway, so out of college, I went to a jazz community college where, like, the Mount Hood Jazz Festival is at. And, like, all those guys get pulled out and go on tour because that's what everybody's goal is. If you're a serious jazz musician, you gotta work. You gotta work. Like, getting the degree is going to somewhat push you towards education.
Now, were you fishing throughout all of this?
No, I fished in school a little bit because I remember that shit about fishing with my dad. I remember that. And my homie was talking about the same thing. And we shared an apartment. And the fisheries department had a pond on there. And so we bought, like, spinning rods and bobbers and worms and stuff. And we'd go to fishing between class. And our keyboard harmony instructor loved trout. So we'd go between class, drink a bunch, fish, drag these fish into keyboard harmony. Our instructor was like, sweet. And, like, be all stoked about it. That was the fishing of my college life.
How did fly fishing start?
It is such long stories. There's two like births of it. I don't even know if they're appropriate for radio. One of them's not appropriate for radio because I was young and I thought that ketamine was... I'd never done it before, so I tried it.
It's a drug?
Yeah, it's like a tranquilizer.
Okay.
For horses, I think. Okay, so I'm hanging out. So I'm a jazz kid, and I live with 10 dudes in Portland, Oregon, and we're playing like four times a week, making $100. You know, 50 to 100 bucks every night. So we're living pretty good.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got 10 dudes and we're all into jazz. We don't know people that don't study jazz for a living kind of thing, you know. And we made this really cool scene in Portland at the Speakeasy. And, like, it was cool. Like, you know, remember the beat poetry stuff and MTV and stuff? Like, MTV News did a little thing about it and, you know, about, like, our just, like, our little subculture jazz scene. Anyway, we'd hang out. Half of us worked at this pizza spot.
Yeah.
And Rocco's Pizza on Burnside in Portland, just downtown, right across from Powell Books. And there's this little wedge. It's just this little wedge in downtown, and we'd get free pizza and beer because, like, some homies work there, you know. So I'm sitting there, and this dude pulls up in this beat-up car that I drink beers with every day. You know, he's not a jazz kid, but you know, he's always hanging out in the same place. And he pulls up and says, like, who fly fishes? Anybody here fly fishing? Everybody's like, no.
What? That's so random.
Yeah. He just goes up to his sidewalk bar and is like, he's itching to go fly fishing, you know. And everybody's like, he's very amped about it. It's like, come on, who did it? Anybody? And I was like, no. And then I was like, and he just kept on asking. I was just like, I'll go. And so I hop in the truck, or I hop in his car, and he has these two plates of something on the back window. I'm like, what the hell is that? And so we go, and he's teaching me how to tie these lines, or tie the knots and the flies on while he's driving, you know, a little bit sketchily, you know?
Yeah.
And, but he's in a hurry. This guy, all he wants to do is catch trout on the chutes right now, you know? And I guess he just didn't want to go alone. I don't know. Anyway, So he gets it, and so he's like, you shake the rod like this, and you tie these knots like that. And I was like, you got it? I was like, I think so, because like I didn't know anything, so I knew a lot more than I did a second, or, you know, before the drive. It's a 3-hour drive, 4-hour drive. And then he has these, he scrapes this stuff off a plate, and he said, this is ketamine. It's like snorting a six-pack. I was just young. I never done a hard drug. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, Jay's fucking weird. So, oh, I'm so sorry about my mouth.
That's okay.
But everybody, you know, thinks I'm weird and that there's some sort of drug thing involved. And it's like, I'm not down with that. And then all of a sudden I was like, I was super, super drunk. And then he says, I remember it kind of like in a weird motion, but he says, you go this way, I go that way. You go downstream, I go upstream. And then it wiped. So then I'm looking for these fish. I have no idea what I'm doing. And I catch squawfish. All of a sudden the thing wears off. I was like, that was crazy. That was like the thing that was crazy. And then everything clicked and I caught some squawfish and I thought they were trout because I just didn't know enough.
And on the fly too.
I took pictures. Yeah. I took pictures and I brought it to him. And he's like, did you catch anything? I was like, yeah, I caught like four. And he's like, yeah, I caught six. And he shows me the picture. Like, man, what the hell did I catch? And he started laughing at me. That was squawfish. I was like, I thought it was sweet. But then I never touched it again. And then this is like part two. So I smoke cigarettes like a chimney, and on these packages, there's these things called miles, and like the UPC code, and it's like 5 miles per package. So I was saving up all of those because, you know, I'm smoking. And then a bunch of homies started giving them to me. So I had enough miles to, I don't know, to get anything in the catalog. But I'm just not a mail-away guy. I've never been I'm not good at like mailing stuff. But I do get this catalog. I'm looking at this like salad spinner, the cigarette brand on it, and then the leather jacket with the cigarettes on it. I was like, this sucks. And then I see Marlboro fly rod and reel. And I was like, that was cool when I caught those squawfish. Like, that was cool as hell. But I had enough to get three of them. I had so, because I'm not a mail away guy. So I have more than I could ever use because I'll never use them. And then my homies come in, the Vine Femmes are playing in Portland, and you could only get in with miles. I was like, I was going to get this fly rod, but you know I was never going to do it. And I just gambled. I got like 14 of my homies into the Vine Femmes. And then I woke up the next morning and there was like a blister pack fly rod from some department store, blister pack fly rod and reel. I was like, sweet.
Wait, the guys got that for you?
Yeah.
Because you had brought them to, that is so cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So then what did you do?
So I had no idea what I was doing. And so I went to a tackle store. And we have sturgeon in the water. You guys got sturgeon up there.
Yeah, so you're in the Columbia Basin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Still in Washington.
I was fishing in Oregon that day.
Okay.
But I was probably living in Oregon too at that point. Went to a smaller creek on the coast. And like I go to the bait shop. I was like, okay, I know they tie stuff on a hook. So I bought some yarn. And then I was like, I want to catch a big ass fish, so I better get a big ass hook. So I got like a 7-aught barbless hook. Like for sturgeon, because that's what they sell. That's the biggest, shiniest hook. I'm like, that's the one. And I tie a bunch of yarn onto it, and then I put crawfish and a smelly jelly. I didn't know that wasn't legit. I had no idea what I was doing. I was like,
sure.
This makes sense to me. This is going to work, you know? And fortunately or unfortunately, it did. And like I went with my friend Nate to this creek, and we caught chums and chinook. We caught a stack of them that day. I broke the rod the first day. We ran to the beach, to the department store at the beach, grabbed another rod, came back out, and we caught a huge stack of salmon. And so I just stayed the night there. And then we were privy to some secrets of the salmon at nighttime. Fish them at nighttime. I have a whole theory behind this, and I don't know.
Is that legal?
It was. And, like, you know, honestly, the biggest mistake they made, like, there was just hoodlums down there. You know, meth, and there was a dude at his house on the river was throwing a net over every night to get his, you know, salmon, all that kind of stuff. You know, needles and shit like that. And then we started hanging out there, and all that stuff stopped. And we'd see that warden. I understand they got a lot of junk on their plate, you know. They got a big ass zone, but we saw them like maybe once a month, you know, maybe a little bit more often than that. But as soon as they kicked us out,
it went back to
it
being.
It just went straight back to it, you know. And, you know, so it's interesting because salmon have rods and cones just like we do. And the percentage of rods and cones dictates, do you see in color or do you see it in black and white? Mm-hmm. And for us, we keep our same rod to cone count at nighttime, so we don't see very well. We see kind of bits of silhouettes in darkness, you know, in the moonlight or whatever. But salmon, that's how they hunt, like at nighttime, and they see like a black and white television, the squid move and the baits, and they see all that stuff move. And then besides that, another part is during the day, you got dudes throwing lines over them and snagging them all day and like all this kind of stuff. And they're just like, they're just lockjaw. They don't want anything to do with it. You know, there's many theories, but I like salmon is definitely what started me on fly fishing. I didn't know what steelhead was. I didn't know what trout was. I was like, that thing's big. I want to learn how to catch it. You know?
Okay. So you're still playing music, but fishing on the side.
No, I sold everything. I got out of that.
Out of music?
Yeah. It was getting like, there was some weird political stuff and, political stuff and like who you play with was not, it wasn't cool if you played with those guys. Oh. But I was like, those guys are my homies, you know? And then it started to get to, you know, that kind of shit where I don't want any of that noise, you know, I can't be bothered. Anyway, and then I didn't have toys and shit when I was a kid. So like when I had that awesome day fly fishing, I was like, I sold everything and bought a shotgun, a fly rod, and a 4x4.
Yeah.
I came from a redneck town and everybody hated, you know, everybody, not everybody, but like people were tough on me, you know. Every day I got called wetback or, you know, something, and I was poor, you know. So like people were pretty tough on me, you know. And so the rednecks, I was like, I ain't down with those guys. And then I become a redneck. I was like, yeah, they're my boys. But right. we don't call people wetbacks around me, you know.
The fishing industry. How did that all happen? You came on my radar with Trout Bums. Was that how this started?
No. So, I moved into my Forerunner, and I started fishing every day. And I had to figure out, like, some sort of income. And I wasn't playing music anymore. And I needed to drink beer at bars at least, you know, slightly regularly. And so I started karaokeing. And there would be, like, these purses. Like, you could win $50. You could win $100. You could win... Once I won... kind of an interesting story. There was called Karaoke in Hollywood in Portland, Oregon. It was like a bracket that you worked through. And then if you won, you get to go karaoke in Hollywood, which was the pilot episode for American Flital. But I didn't want to go karaoke in Hollywood. I just wanted to win some cash, drink some beer, get gas and ramen to steelhead fish, you know? And so I won and got the money and I took off. They're like, okay, you get a free trip to Hollywood. Like, okay, tight, I'll meet you there. And just brought it out to go steelhead fishing for like 4 months. Because I didn't need no money. I didn't have no bills, you know.
Where do you enter the industry, and was it on purpose?
Yeah, so I was fly fishing for, like, springtime is the best time for steelhead. The most vigorous, beautiful prime specimens of the steelhead enter in the spring. And in the Northwest, it's a good spot to be for it. Not as good as where you're from, but... But we have to take what we get, you know. But then I start messing around with carp. This is a long time ago, and I know everybody says, like, oh, carp, I've been fishing carp for, it was cool, all this kind of stuff. It was a long time ago. And there's this lake behind Ray Jeff Sports, Tim Ray Jeff's house, that had, like, a whole ton of carp. And I'd catch them on dry flies. I'd catch them on... they were a difficult fish to catch. Like, I'm in Colorado, these fish are extremely easy to catch. The easiest carp I've ever seen in the world. But there, it was difficult. And we're dealing with still water in a. If it rains, it blows out. And, you know, also, and I don't, there's nothing written on carp. I can't be like, oh, you know, if they're cruisers, they do this. If they're spawning, they do this. Anyway, so, but I figured it out. And so, I'd break stuff every once in a while. I'd bring it back to Ray Jeff Sports, which was right on the lake that I was fishing. I'd be like, yo. Like, and he knew that I was a hood rat, so he's like, yeah, I don't have $35 like for the rod fee or something like that. Just give me one of the best of tips, and I, you know, set me up, you know. And so anyway, so I'm like, give me a job. He's like, because I read Kearns Creek Manifesto. Do you remember Kearns Creek Manifesto?
I don't think so.
It's like a comic book by Shelton Anderson that's like how to fly fish, and that's the only thing I had, you know. And they're like, this guy was the greatest. And I took so much, but a lot of the stuff he said wasn't just straight law. But one of the things that is he says, if you think you're a good caster, you're just a big fish in a little pond. And so I was like, where's the biggest fucking pond? It's like the Ray Jeff brothers. And so I was like, anyway, so I'm like, I'm trying to get a job, like working for the dude. And like, keep on coming in. He's like, no, man, no, we can't hire you. We can't hire you. And then one time the last time I came in, I was like, I'll give you $2 an hour if I can work here. He's like, I can't do that, but I'll just hire you. Here's the deal. If you want to go fishing, you go fishing. If you're not fishing, you come to work. Like, sounds like a deal.
To do what? What was your role?
Well, it started as like checking rods, like if they, you know, how I would have to put together every single rod and give it a false cast and see if it's everything was right. Like quality stuff. And then I was working on somewhat internet marketing, like what forums said back in the day of certain lines. Like there would be people that had never touched an airflow line. There are people that had never cast it before, but on a forum, they're like, yeah, that thing sucks. You know, so I'd be like, why? You know, or something, or have you ever used one, you know, and then, and, you know, and that was, it was kind of cool, like, start messing around with some sort of concepts of marketing, you know, but not like the main marketing shit that they were, you know, those guys, are, they do their thing, you know. And then we worked on some products and got to design some stuff. And then all of a sudden music came back into my life. And like Hank Williams Sr. was like one of the only country dude that I just completely loved, you know.
I grew up on him. Well, yeah. I mean, I grew up on NWA, but my dad.
Me too.
Yeah. But those two.
Exactly.
So ironic. Okay.
I would listen, you know, if I was ever driving a beach as a kid or as like, you know, a young adult, I would play Hank Williams Sr. And it, you know, it just made me feel good. So all of a sudden, his grandson, Hank III, is like, well, you know, come on tour, you know, open up for us in this country band. And like, and so, yeah, so what happened while I was at Radio Sports, man, there's such long stories, but an old homie is like, dude, you should play country. I was like, I'm not going to play country. He's like, oh, you should come play country. I was like, I don't think I'm down with it. And he's like, you'll be down. These people are great and the fans are great. So and it was great, you know, it was super fun. And then, so I was, all of a sudden I was playing music again in a country band, which is just so different than whatever I pictured in my life. So I told Tim, I was like, yeah, they're doing this 3-month tour across the United States. I kind of want to go, you know. And Tim was like, if you don't go, I'll fire you. And so, I mean, like, Tim's like my dad. He's like,
great.
Tim, as much as a father as I can have, and he don't got no kids, you know, so he kind of took me under his wing. Because this dude, so he would, we'd go to like IFTD or these shows and stuff like that, and like, because I was a fish rat. I was like, you know, living in the forum, you know, and everybody he introduced me to was like, this is Jay. This, if I want to know something about fly fishing, I ask him. And so everybody's like, who the hell is, you know? Yeah. But I, you know, I had some chops. So that was like my first like entrance into it, you know? And then.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, like that dude reached down and grabbed a very confused boy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, I don't think I was confused, but like.
He's a very smart man.
Holy smokes. So, and the sweetest, kindest, like you get to just yapping with him.
He would have known what was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did that. But during that time, okay. So, and a little bit before that, the Trout Bum Diary stuff started and they wanted to use one of my songs.
Oh my goodness. It's clicking. Cause at the time, who was that? That was Chris Owens.
Brian Gill, Ryan Davey, Thad, and Justin, I think.
Was Justin even there yet?
No.
Was Mikey there?
No, at that time, maybe Justin wasn't there. Mikey wasn't there.
He wasn't there yet?
He was, I think he did, because this was for the second, or for, so that was, the first film was Patagonia, and the next film was New Zealand.
Okay, so you're coming on, not the first round, you're coming on...
The second. Gotcha. Well, that's when we started communicating in the film tour and all that kind of stuff.
Because they want to use your music.
Yeah. So I was like, and we were on tour at the time, and we were playing South by Southwest. And I talked to Brian Jones. I was like, he's like, you know, can we use your shit? And I was like, meet me down at South by Southwest. We'll have a yap because I don't know what's going on, you know. And he does. And like we just have this epic time, and like ended up talking a lot about fly fishing. And then they were like, come up on the next one, and figure this stuff out.
Coming up, Jay and I continue our conversation. Again, thank you to Cross Current Insurance Group for sponsoring this episode of Anchored. Cross Current is an insurance agency that is staffed by anglers who are dedicated to working solely with the fly fishing and outdoor industries, while also giving back to the causes that we all care about. Cross Current offers industry-specific products available for guides, outfitters, captains, manufacturers, retailers, and nonprofits, and part of their profits will always be committed to conservation. Go to www.flyfishinginsurance.com or find them on Instagram to learn more.
It was groundbreaking at the time, too.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it still is. Because yeah, then from I there, mean, then you guys went to, what was three, Mongolia?
Mongolia. I didn't go. That's when I was on the Hank III tour.
Okay, so you went on tour with Hank III.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, so I did the tour, and those boys went to Mongolia, and then I'm looking at the footage back home, and I'm like, I really fucked up. because there was so much drugs and stuff on that tour that, like, I was mother henning because I start to worry about my homies. I start to worry about people that I don't even know. And then, like, instead of me having a fun time and being like, this is rad, you know, I'm like, oh, I got to worry about that guy dying. I got to worry about that guy dying. What's going to happen to this guy today? And it's like, I'm just a mother hen. That's not me. That's not, like, that's not my bag. But I knew that I was done with music.
Now, did they do a fourth one? When did they do Metalheads?
Then we did Metalhead, yeah. And during that time, we started the film tour. So, like,
right.
Like all of this wave of change is happening on these films and the film tour. And, you know, just it was cool to see fly fishing change from a certain age and income level and ethnicity and even to the shirt to what it is now. And there's, like, there's some hip kids running through there, you know, like, that think that fly fishing's bitching. I'm like, I'm down.
It was a major transition.
It's pretty impactful. I don't think
it was
people
cool.
Understand the impact of it until like we're all old. And I think they're going to look at us like the Bones Brigade. I hope, because I was like so stoked on the Bones Brigade. You know?
I think that the appreciation is definitely very much already there. We talk about it all the time on the show. So the show is, like I said, it's a way to archive our history, and the Trope Bum era is constantly referenced. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean,
to me, that's when it's changed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, and I'm too young to really know what it was like before then, but I was there long enough to watch it change in a big way. And just hear the complaining. I mean, it caused a ruckus. The older guys were really upset about it.
I remember that, man.
A lot of them were. I mean, some of them were supportive, but a lot of them were not. You know, and I think that you guys really started that shift.
That pissed me off, like, pretty greatly. There's some older dudes that, like, have offended me in that. And all they taught me, though, is that I won't be that way when the next people come up, you know.
That's right. Okay, so then from there, what was your next move? Because you confused me, and now that I'm sitting down with you, it all makes sense. Because I was like, what the hell is he doing with his career? He's fishing, now he's doing tattoos. Now he's doing, like, I felt like you were always dabbling in something, and I get it now. You're talented in a number of arenas, and you are a little scattered, and that's totally fine. And do you feel like your career has kind of shown that?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's the next, because I've been doing it for a little while.
The Pig Farm Inc.?
Yeah.
So what was it? Because this is what my perception of it was. You guys were going and getting tattooed. You find someone's tattoo that was ugly. That they didn't want.
Worst tattoo you could find.
Yeah. And then you would pay, I guess, to get it removed?
Yeah, they got sponsored to get it removed.
Right, but then you took it on.
We didn't know how to tattoo, and then we tattoo them on us. And then people and other people want those tattoos now. It's interesting.
But what was the...
How does it connect?
Yes.
Well, I mean, it
And
works.
Can I see one? What's the worst one you've got on you?
I mean, I don't got any bad ones.
Oh, okay, so you didn't take any of the bad ones.
No, I mean, I took them all, but I don't think they're bad.
you know? I gotcha.
So this one, this guy showed up to a, it's a dick chicken. So it's like, I had him put rocket, like, you know, explosions underneath it. That the original one just looked like the dick chicken, but I had him put the rocket stuff on.
Wow. Okay, you have to explain. I'm totally now you've lost me. Okay, so first of all, you're happy with putting those tattoos on you.
Every single one of them is a story. Is such a okay so example. So we the whole point of it is to build communities. We go on. We did it in our community where we build events, get everybody together. But I knew how big the fly fishing industry was because we sold the top selling DVDs of all time for that stuff. And I also knew what everybody at IFTD said every year was that we're shrinking after River Runs Through It, we're shrinking. And so through all these lessons I've learned of all this stuff in life, well, you know, which the number one lesson that I think needs to be said and that people need to teach other people is do good. Because before I was just trying to survive and I was like, I'm a musician. I'm all these things that is for my own ego. It's for me, for like, I needed to eat. I need to feel love. I needed to feel that shit. And then eventually you find out that's not the answer, you know, and to find the way I see shit, the way I see it is that, like, how do you feel about my Uncle Daryl?
How do I feel? I do not know your
You don't know my Uncle Daryl because you've never been exposed to my Uncle Daryl.
Right.
That's kind of like how the kids are right now with the outdoor world, is that they're playing video games and they're playing cell phones, and that's their interactions. And they don't know my Uncle Daryl, and they don't know the outside. We're screwed, right? We're screwed because, I mean, not my Uncle Daryl, he was, you know, changed my life, but the outdoors, that's, look through that span of the conversation we've had, and it all came down to that creek and me wanting to just be out there and connect when everybody else I was in the group home was in jail and, you know, all these troubles and all this kind of stuff, you know. So anyway, we go through some stuff. I went through a divorce, and I was like, but I was working on Geofish at the time, and a homie Matt calls, and he's going through a divorce too, and like, he was not, it sounded really bad, and I was like, I was thinking to myself, because I had one of my best fishing friends shot himself in the head, and that made me very, very sensitive to when people have any sort of talks around, you know, not wanting to, you know, live or whatever. And I was like, so why do I want to live? And that's because I was working on a project. And so I was like, Matt, let's do a project, and we'll make fly fishing communities across the United States. And Matt was like, okay. And it pulled him out of that darkness and me out of the darkness. Cause like, it was the toughest thing I ever went through in my life was that divorce, you know.
How long were you married for?
I don't know. I think 6 years, but maybe four or maybe seven. So I'm not good at that kind of stuff.
That's okay. You don't have to be.
I'm not good at that kind of stuff. But it was awesome. Divorce, I can say it was awesome.
Is hard.
Oh, it was so brutal.
I mean, it has to be, right?
So brutal. And now I got to edit Geofish, that first movie where we took a truck, converted it from a vegetable at my house and drove all the way we drove to Peru eventually, you know.
So you did that after the divorce or during the divorce?
We filmed it.
While you were married?
We filmed from Vancouver, Washington to Panama while I was married.
Okay, can you explain to people what that film was?
Well, it didn't get turned into films.
This is the one that was sold to television.
Yeah, well, so it was all Costa and Al. It was like, let's do Seven Continents, 7 years, you know, and so we're trying to figure out how to do this and all, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we start just booking. We got the truck now, and now we're swapping used vegetable oil for fuel, and we're like, we can book a long time.
And how many guys were there?
Four of us.
Okay, so you guys got a vehicle. You're working with Costa and Al at the time, and
Patagonia at the time, and 3M.
Yeah, right. Okay, and then so what was the plan? How long was this trip supposed to take?
Well, we didn't know.
And you're driving from where? From Washington to?
Washington to, we're trying to get to Tierra del Fuego.
Okay.
So anyway, so I'm coming back every few months, and we're working on the film, trying to get all this stuff, and we put out that first film, Geofish, where we drive from there to Belize, or from home to Belize, and we got all this interest from like Nat Geo, and you know, a bunch of people were like, hey, what's the story with this thing? What's the story with this thing? And then we started to get into all these negotiations about trying to figure out like, what do we, you know, we wanted to make sure that it's tough from going to making films to going to TV.
Oh, it's a very different world, totally different world.
And the creative control of something is very, for me, is more important than the money and all that kind of stuff. And I don't really deal with bullshit because I don't deal with phones and that kind of stuff, you know? So during that time, we were negotiating these contracts, trying to figure out how to make everything, like, how can we all be happy with the situation? Like, the bass guys in Costa and all these huge sponsors that weren't in the fly fishing industry. And this is where I think it matters, and it's you know, somewhat historic. It's the first time, like, it was a fly fishing thing that wasn't sponsored by fly fishermen. That wasn't sponsored by fly fishing companies, for the most part, you know. Right. Or, you know, not, I mean, Costa. It was Costa, GoPro, like Mountain Dew, Budweiser, Carhartt, you know, like stuff that was like BASS, like they're like, let's do something about exploring bass fishing as opposed to just like, you know, the competition stuff.
Now this went to television though, right?
No, Geobass didn't. No, that was distributed to all those big sponsors.
But Motive did.
Yeah.
Okay, so
Motive, so yeah, and then it you know, it did its thing, and then all of a sudden it's kind of funny, this guy. Now just put yourself in my situation. This guy sends me an email and says, my name is Brad Johnson, Google me. And so the first thing I do is not answer that and throw it in the trash. And then
that's all he sent in an email?
Yeah. Dad did. And he did like Arrested Development, My Name is Earl, all the way back to like Coach and Major Dad. Like the guy's a genius, and he's been hitting in Hollywood for like 30 years, you know.
Right.
He's like, I wanted to do a story about obsessed fly fishermen, and I Google searched and I found you guys. I'm like, what do you want to do? Anyway, so the long process it goes, and eventually by surprise, it's like I was working on a project in Nepal for an indie fly thing, and I get this message of like, you know, Anaplan wants to roll now, what do you think? And it turned into that kind of stuff, which was not, it wasn't my goal in life. That wasn't my goal in life. You know, that was more, you know, I would like to take this time in my life to like hit my missions.
What are your missions?
Well, that's that whole stuff that relates to the outdoors and the battle of the, it's us versus the cell phones and video games, you know? And then the indie fly stuff is, have you, you know anything about indie fly at all?
Not enough. And just assume my listener doesn't know anything.
Well, it's Al and some boys did some stuff down in Guyana where they...
Is this the thing with Oliver White?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So that became an organization where... And, you know, so this village never had income coming into it. And now it's got 85% of that village is employed, and they own it. They own it. Like, they own the business, you know, and all that kind of stuff. We just... help them along on that stuff. So I've been working on projects like last 5 years up in the Wind River and Indian Reservation, and then in Nepal for the last couple of years. But there's a couple other projects. There's, so I travel a lot, right? Because of all the shows and all that stuff. And like, you end up making lifelong friends, and you see how you can make some huge impacts on that kind of stuff. But now it's just having enough time, and then doing a show doesn't give you very much time to do much of that. And then I got the pig farm stuff.
So you're still doing that?
The pig farm stuff?
Like the Pig Farm Inc. stuff?
Yeah.
Okay, so did that go to television?
That's what I want. No.
That's just on YouTube?
Yeah, but it's not. Pig Farm is a community. Is like communities. And we want to get people that aren't fly fishing to come check, give a gander at it. So we throw events that are fun, that make people get into fly fishing. So this guy showed, the guy with the dick chicken, he showed up to one of the Iron Flies. It was like Iron Chef meets Fly Time. But really... it's the first challenge to teach someone that's never tied. We always do the Iron Fly in a bar. We get the table set up in the middle of the bar, and I get up to the crowd and I say, we're looking for the worst tattoo in this room. If anybody's can beat ours, we'll remove it for free and tattoo it on us. So now everybody's listening, and people are bringing up their bad tattoos. Everybody is having a chuckle and, you know, having a good time. And I say, and we're doing a fly tying contest over here, and no one listens. No one gives a shit, you know. And we go back to the bad tattoos. Everybody's laughing. And then the people that come for the challenge, I say, okay, your first challenge is to teach someone that's never tied a fly to tie a San Juan worm. First winner usually gets a pair of cosas. And so they race up out of their seats and get those people in. And then those people have never tied a fly. They've never thought of fly fishing in their life or anything. And now they're having the best time. They're having a real original experience with some outdoor kids that are pretty cool. And then all the people behind them want to get in on that too. And clever. Then we take that through the nation, you know. So we got this other one called Get Trashed, where you build teams of however many you want, and for each bag of garbage you pick up, it's worth 50 points. Each thing that doesn't fit in a bag is worth 50 points. But each new angler that catches their first fish on your team is worth 25 points. And so you want to stack your team with new anglers. And then you go pick up the river. And those guys are picking up the river and learning to fish. And everybody's giving them this great attention of like, and learning and all this kind of stuff. And when they catch a fish, people fucking celebrate. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And because they're getting the big points and like, and these, they caught their first fish. And so people party their face off. You know, it's like, it's cool. You know, it's cool. And then we have one called American Flytle, where that's my favorite one. It's one of our most successful too. We've only done it in a few cities, but we do it in my hometown. We used to do it in my hometown for like 2 years. But it's just fly tying night with karaoke. And so in my hometown we got a couple Filipinos, including myself. And I don't know if you know if you've heard of the stories of how Filipinos karaoke, but you know, it's legendary. No, I'm just joking. The Filipinos love karaoke, but so same with my homie Nikki. And so we'll get there and we'll start tying flies, and all the people will show up to tie flies and we'll sing songs. And the people that are singing songs that didn't come for fly tying are like, what the fuck are you guys doing? They're like, oh, tying flies, check it out. And then the next thing you know, they're like, oh, well, you know, how do I get a rod? Like, what's the story on that? You know, it's cool. It's cool. It's like,
You have more projects than anybody I think I've ever met in my life.
I think so. And then you stack on top of that, me and a homie lease a farm.
Tell me about this farm. You told me about this flat when I saw you. Was it last year that you told? Yeah, last year you told me about this farm. And you've done it. So did you go out and buy a farm? Or are you renting a farm?
No, just leased. Originally it was by this company, Mother Love Herbal Company. And not to be crude, but they make stuff for breastfeeding women to create more milk or to like not hurt. And so...
Oh, you mean like salve to put on your nipples?
Yeah. Called nipple cream. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I used it religiously when I was feeding because you get blisters really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for like 6 years, I was living in an Airstream in my back of my homie's backyard.
I love Airstreams. Do you still have one?
No, it was his. Okay. I was just kind of borrowing it for 6 years. Yeah. I told him I'd never move out. I told him I'd never move out, but I did.
Okay.
I shouldn't have. I'm moving back, Mark.
Okay, so the farm.
Yeah, so they wanted to start growing some herbs locally because they were hard to source. The goat shrew increases lactation, and they have to buy it. And to get it certified organic, they have to buy it from some spots and sometimes from Eastern Bloc Europe, and they can't get it sometimes. And it's like it's the number one product in two of their top-selling products.
Yeah, they have to grow their own.
So they start farming it, you know.
Yeah.
And then, but it only took like 2 acres. And this farm that they leased was like 120 acres. It's 160 now. And they hired my homie RJ to run it, Sporty Dove. And then it got to be just too much work for 2 acres that they wanted us to lease it. And so we leased it. We've been leasing it for the last few years. And to operate it on a whole system, you need animals crapping on ground. For an organic system, the more manure you can get on the ground. So we had to stage up the livestock production to make sure all those fields get fertilized, and then those fields are actually... So we sell beef, pork, and lamb.
Okay, so you're not talking a farm. I mean, you're talking cattle.
No, it's like it's 35 cattle a year, or 35 cattle total. We probably sell 4 or 5 a year, and then we do 50 pigs a year. We have 50 pigs at most of the time in different stages of growth in different pasture, and then 50 sheep. But we don't sell 50 sheep. We sell like just the lambs, the male lambs.
Yeah. I thought you were running a hobby farm. Because my place in BC, I do have a neighbor. They live a ways down, and they're the best neighbors in the world. And they watch my place when I'm gone. And when they're gone, I watch their hobby farm. And they only have chickens and ducks, 10 sheep, 2 horses and a donkey, and yes, that it. Yeah, and a couple dogs, and that keeps me busy. I can't leave. I mean, yeah. It keeps me smoking busy. How do you do that?
Dude, and then we have to grow the feed for them.
Yeah. Well, how do you manage? And is it just you and
other
guy?
RJ, no, and this guy Robbie.
Okay,
Robbie Capps came from Alabama. Like when I started doing that show, like I don't have anybody that can. I don't have anybody in my life that could do this.
The farm.
I just don't. Yeah, they couldn't be. They couldn't be a farmer. You know. I just don't know anybody that's into it.
Everything has done a full circle back. I get it now. This is like in the elevator, you were saying you hadn't had time alone in as long as you could remember.
Yeah, because I've been doing that show with the boys, and then the pig farm. Like right before that, we did like a month long pig farm. We did like four. We did a ton of monster pig farm tours. It's just been so long since I was like, you know, everybody needs it. Everybody needs that time. But I'll burn so hard on both ends. That's why I take all that stuff on.
You know, do you have
because
kids?
I got it. No.
You need to go.
Go ahead.
Like, you need to go.
Go where?
Anywhere.
I know. I got to get done with this. And then, I mean, because
yeah,
that's
the
other
always
things,
the
like,
next project, the next project, the next
people
project.
People die. You know, with it's indie fly stuff. People can die. Like, if I don't get on stuff, if I don't stay on stuff, then I'm in trouble. It's like the Five River system. I don't give them enough. You know anything about Five River stuff?
No, but I think that I know a lot about taking 7 days to disappear in the bush and not talk to anybody.
I need to. I got this teepee.
Would you like the key to my cabin? Because I will give it to you in Smithers, and you should just go.
I can't get up there right now. That would be impossible. But at some point, yeah. Obviously, Smithers rules. Like that's one of the happiest places on earth. Is that whole state or province?
Province. What's next for you?
I'm done. I think I'm done with the farming thing. Yeah, we're trying to find somebody to take over, but like so much stuff has suffered. Like the progress with the show and the farm, progress on the Indie Fly projects, Five Rivers projects, and Pig Farm. It's been really tough to get out. Still get out to do some of it, but I don't get to do much of it. And like, this is after that show, the Fish or Die stuff, which I'm just saying that because I feel like I'm supposed to say that.
What, Fish or Die? Which is, what is that?
That's the TV show on Animal Planet, but...
Oh, is that what they ended up calling it?
I didn't name it. I wanted it to be called Wet Dreams.
Oh, okay. I can understand why it wasn't.
Yeah, right. Okay. Right. But yeah, that was cool. That was awesome. Worked with a lot of really cool people, you know. But that's, I met people around the world that I'll be best friends with forever.
Yeah.
And if I'm working a farm and doing a TV show, I don't get to see them.
It's true. And it's a lot of work.
I want to just tour for the rest of the year, do a YouTube channel, and throw Pig Farm events, work on Indie Fly stuff, and get out to those people and try to develop like some sort of fisheries for those indigenous people that have changed my life. You know, that I've like, because you go out in the jungle for 2 months with somebody that you met previously, and like we go into these villages and we'll drink for a few days, like just hang out and tell people what we're doing. No one cares because it's like they don't know what fly fishing is, they don't know what ice is, you know, all this kind of stuff. They don't care about that world. And then you bring them out in the jungle, you show them some stuff about ice fishing, they help you survive through all this stuff with snakes, and you become best friends with them. After a while, you got your crew, and like after we leave, is we're all gone, you know, and they're back to some pretty tough existences sometimes. If there is some chances to close some of those up, you know, have time to actually put real deal work, not have to worry about a farm, not have to worry about a TV show, just get the stuff that matters to me most, you know, and live on the road. This is the first time I had a house in a long time, you know, and living at it was nice. It was cool. I was ready for it, you know, get away from the bars and like do hard labor and think. It's a lot of thinking, you know, which I love. You know, this is one of my things.
That sort of life is not easy, but is it rewarding? Are you happy?
Oh, it's the coolest thing. It's like, I wouldn't trade that. I wouldn't like, that was like my university to me, you know, I wouldn't trade it. And maybe some other day I'll do it. But while like the show gives me a certain forum, my history or, you know, like all my stuff gives me a certain forum. While I have that forum and I'm able, I got to try to get to every community and teach, or, you know, like show everything that I've learned from those situations. If that goes down, or, you know, if that, I got to strike while I have a nice forum. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but remember, you can't strike at all if you're not here.
I know. The only thing that could get me, there's the main thing that could get me is cigarettes, but I think I got like 20 years. I don't know.
I'm not saying anything.
I don't know. And, no, I don't got 20 years. I don't got 20 years in that. Yeah, you're right. I know. I got to take care of myself.
You do. But in your head, I mean. In your head.
Yeah, I got to take care of my head. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to have more time after this week.
I'm going to hold you to that.
Yeah, I will. I will. I'm going to do it.
Well, listen, I'm going to wrap this up. Is there anything that you would like to add or to ask me?
Could I say thank you to two sponsors that have helped me live this thing? And it's Al Perkinson from Costa. He was at Costa for a long time. That he really made all of that, this stuff possible. And yeah, he's like my mentor and like my other dad, you know.
He's a great guy, huh?
He's like, when he speaks, his speaking is always very valuable to me, you know. And then Sims too has helped us out a lot on the pig farm and getting that stuff done. So you know, there's a ton of companies that I just don't want it to turn into that kind of thing, and I owe it to those guys to say it. So anyway, yeah.
Well, thank you to them for keeping you around.
It makes it possible.
Right,
you know,
it does.
It helps make all this stuff is expensive, extremely expensive to do.
Well, I'm going to wrap it up. Thank you so much for coming on the show.